Recess after the first oral argument. The second case scheduled for oral argument today is case number A20-0380, State of Minnesota versus William Dean Brown. Counsel, as you know, you each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. If you keep your settings in a certain way, you'll be able to see the time clock. Appellant's counsel, of course, will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Mr. Umstead, you may approach and begin.
All right. Good afternoon, Your Honors and counsel. May it please the court. When the officer in this case arrested Mr. Brown, there was nothing remarkable about the encounter. Mr. Brown was lucid and he was cooperative, and he admitted to using marijuana several months beforehand, but nothing about his behavior or his statements on the night in question suggested that drugs would be present in the car he was driving, which belonged to his girlfriend. In fact, the officer searched the car when he arrested Mr. Brown for driving while revoked, and he didn't find anything to indicate the presence of drugs. Even so, several hours later, the officer called a canine sniff of the car, and the only thing that changed between that time of Mr. Brown's arrest and the eventual canine search was the officer's review of a four-month-old police encounter where Mr. Brown was pulled over in a different car, and the officer at that time found unidentified substances that were never determined to be unlawful. And based on this stale information, which, like I said, related to an entirely different car, the officer worked backwards from there to find reasonable suspicion. An innocent-looking bag underneath one of the car seats suddenly looked incriminating. Mr. Brown's concerns about his girlfriend trying to pick up her car suddenly looked like a cover-up. And the straw found in his pocket that he chewed on to address saliva issues stemming from a facial injury as a child, now it suddenly related to drugs, notwithstanding the fact that there was no drug residue on the straw or any other reason to otherwise associate it with drugs. And so that's what I mean in my briefing when I referred to the May 2019 report as the crutch supporting the state's reasonable suspicion analysis. It props up the state's entire case by turning innocent information into allegedly incriminating information.
Would you agree that the law that we should apply here is whether, based on the totality of circumstances, there was a reasonable articulable suspicion that there was a crime being committed? And
certainly, Your Honor, I agree that that's the standard, and I also agree that innocent evidence can build up, you know, as a totality of the circumstances can lead to reasonable suspicion, but it's an objective test and there has to be reasonable inferences to sort of make that shift from innocent in isolation to incriminating in totality. And so if we've got a series of facially innocent information, there has to be, I don't know, something to lasso them all together and to suggest that drugs would be found in the particular...
But it's a lower standard than probable cause. Am I correct?
You are correct. And now on that point, it's a lower evidentiary standard, but I cite a case, I want to say it's called Ornelas versus United States. It's United States Supreme Court, which says the questions are the same. The principles, the components are the same for reasonable, articulable suspicion and probable cause. And that the lower standard of reasonable articulable suspicion is an evidentiary standard. So what the kind of upshot to our case is that these staleness issues and these nexus issues, these are, I don't know, kind of high level principles that govern the entire reasonable suspicion analysis, sort of separate and apart from the evidentiary threshold of how, like, if we're stacking evidence on top of each other, how much needs to be there? And the best
Mr. Umstead, can I follow up with that? Perhaps you've sure. at least in part answered my question. That is what I was going to inquire about, since we know it's a lower standard and the officer, by process of elimination, must have something more than mere whim or caprice. Would it not be true that we would look at the SOTO factors as it relates to staleness in a different way to reasonableness as we would to probable cause? Meaning the same set of facts may not support a search warrant, but might support, as the trial judge found here, a basis for a dog sniff, which requires that lower standard.
I don't recall seeing a case that says that. I think I understand the argument that if the reasonable suspicion standard is a lower standard, maybe it's lower at all points. Maybe it takes less to less necessary to establish ongoing criminal activity. Maybe it requires less to show a nexus. I don't recall seeing a case in my research here that stands. So my understanding is it's the reasonable suspicion in general tends to have the lower evidentiary burden.
Let me ask it maybe slightly different way. Would you agree that the requirements for a fresh evidence when probable cause for search warrant is of course heightened, because if you're going to enter one's home, for instance, you don't rely on stale evidence. But now we're talking about reasonableness, a lesser standard, and then of course by virtue of our case law, the dog sniff requires that, but it's a much less intrusive.
Would we
therefore view a 4-month-old report of an item that had the appearance, at least an initial charge, as I understand there was no ultimate conviction from, the offense of drugs, add to the evidence such that a reasonable list, it's more than mere whim or caprice, which I think in a nutshell, as I read the judge's order, that's how she came down.
I think that's fair as far as it goes, Your Honor, but I think that the 4 months would be stale, or would be too elongated in time under the reasonable suspicion or the probable cause standard. And so then the sort of nestled question into that is whether there's even enough under a reasonable suspicion standard to show an ongoing criminal activity. Because I think the way I read Soto and the other cases is that stale is stale, more or less. And then you look at these factors to determine whether something that's, let's say it's something that's 10 days old, is that stale? You look at these other factors, where if something's 4 months old, there's got to be a higher showing to create a reasonable suspicion on the night in question. There has to be. So, I mean, maybe I'm getting wrapped around the axle a little bit here, because
I was going to ask that. Are you referring to degrees of staleness? So your point being here, if that same report had been the day before versus 4 months, the amount of import for the judge in analyzing a reasonableness objectively is less.
Precisely. Yeah. I think that the ongoing criminal activity question becomes a lot more significant to make 4 month old information non-stale than something that happened yesterday or last week, because just by virtue of the closer proximity in time, something that happened yesterday or last week is a lot closer to, I mean, frankly, it's a lot closer to being ongoing criminal activity on its face. But once we get even, I'm having a hard, because there's almost like two different thresholds here. There's the, what does it take to make 4 month old information like probative, just baseline probative to what's happening 4 months later? And then what's the difference between the threshold for reasonable suspicion versus probable cause? And I think no matter how we slice it, under the lower standard, when we've got a 4 month old piece of evidence, and this is before we even get to the crime place nexus.
Can I ask you, I mean, this is a criticism that was raised by the respondent here, is that you seem to just focus on this one report from 4 months earlier, whereas there's a number of factors that the district court looked at objectively, including the fact that he was had an active warrant for an arrest. He had the cut straw in his pocket. He had his admission to using drugs. His request to have someone get the car, and observation of the tan bag under the passenger seat. So there's all these other circumstances. I mean, wasn't it appropriate for the court to consider those other circumstances, and that was part of, you know, as part of an objective test that would warrant a person of reasonable caution to believe that a dog sniff of a car, an abandoned car, was not unreasonable.
So, Your Honor, I wouldn't fault the items or the information that the court can say. I don't think that there's anything, I mean, with the possible exception of the stale report, I don't think there's anything that's out of bounds to look at. But the North Star here is if there's a particularized suspicion that drugs would be found in the car at the time of the search. And so if we're looking at a straw in his pocket, and in my brief, I mentioned all the reasons to not take judicial notice that straw was used for drugs. There wasn't anything in the record of residue, et cetera. But let's say there was residue on this straw, what about the straw on his person suggests that there's drugs in his girlfriend's car? Because the officer knew this was his girlfriend's car. My girlfriend's at work. She's, you know, I'm using the car while she's at work. And so to tie it back to the place in question, like, what about his active warrant for a probation violation? I'll emphasize, for not checking in with his probation officer. So at least one step removed.
Well, except isn't he on probation, though, for possession of drugs?
A conviction from 2013. So, right. So if we're looking at particular
midnight,
yeah. Sure. Yeah. So that to focus the inquiry on the night in question, I think September 4th, 2019, what about the facts, the car on that night, would a reasonable officer to think that there would be drugs in that particular, not did he, I don't know, use drugs? I don't think there's any evidence in the record to suggest he was using drugs. And so to focus in on the crime place nexus, like, what about that car? What about the circumstance on that night would create a reasonable suspicion to find drugs in that car?
Mr. Olmstead, could I inquire to follow up Judge Hooten's question? How much of the information did the officer know about the warrant? I presume he knew the offense and a warrant, but did the record indicate, or the judge find, that the officer knew the basis for the warrant?
I think in his report, there's something in the record, and I can't remember if it's the report or if it's the body cam video, but there was a question asked to Mr. Brown about the warrant. And there's something along the lines of Mr. Brown saying, oh yeah, you know, I don't like checking in with my probation officer or something. I think that made its way into the officer's report as well, that this was a failure to check in at the regular intervals as required for probation.
And might that piece of information have become more significant for the officer after reading the May report? In other words, you know, if there's a report in May that somebody is found with meth on his person, and then we know that in the meantime, he's not been checking in with probation, perhaps he's avoiding urinalysis tests and so on. I mean, might that cause a reasonable officer to then develop suspicion about whether he's using and possessing at that time?
I followed the argument. My concern is that we're moving one or two links beyond not checking in with the officer. And then it becomes a question whether that's a reasonable inference or a reasonable step to take, to, especially without a follow-up, interview with Mr. Brown, that Mr. Brown was Mirandized, gave information, was very candid, frankly, admitting to marijuana a few months ago. And there was nothing in the record to suggest any drug related information. And I think it would be speculation for the officer to assume that.
Back to the staleness issue, because I guess I'm not convinced that it is stale. 4 months seems not such a long time. Is there case law that says in general 4 months is stale, or you know, in context, you know, in this context, 4 months is stale. I'm just not persuaded of that point yet. But
so I cited a case, and I'm just running a word search here to see. It's State versus Ward as a Minnesota Court of Appeals case. I can't remember if it's in my opening brief or my reply that says if it's isolated information of wrongdoing, that it'll support a search or seizure for a few days at best. And so if I recall the case correctly, that then leads into the ongoing criminal activity. If there's something to draw from a few days, from a few months, draw that information to the present day to say that the activity he was involved in this case, 4 months prior, what do we have to assume that he's engaged in the same activity today? I see I'm out of time. If there's any wrap up questions, I'm happy to answer.
It appears there's no additional questions at this time, but I suspect there will be when you appear again for your rebuttal argument. Thank you, Mr. Umstead.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may begin. Please introduce yourself and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Lauren Johnson and I am an assistant McLeod County attorney here today representing the state of Minnesota. As you're well aware, this case is about whether or not Officer Andrew Feeblecorn of the Glencoe Police Department had reasonable, articulable suspicion based on a totality of the circumstances to perform a dog sniff of the vehicle in which appellant was driving and was the sole occupant. As has been discussed, the standard of review here is de novo, meaning that the appellate court can review this matter and incorporate information from the district court's record and gives no deference to the district court's findings. As has also been discussed, the reasonable articulable suspicion standard applies here. This is a dog sniff case, which is not a search that requires probable cause based on the Fourth Amendment or the Minnesota Constitution. And that's because it's much less intrusive. It's only going to reveal the presence of narcotics and is not going to reveal anything embarrassing or private owned by a citizen. And solely it will show whether or not narcotics are present.
Ms. Johnson, if we were to accept your argument in this case and affirm in this case, how would that reasoning not authorize a police officer to do a dog sniff of Mr. Brown's car every time they see him park his car, you know, in the county?
Your Honor, there are multiple circumstances that justify reasonable articulable suspicion in this case specifically. This is always going to be a case-by-case standard. So simply because Mr. Brown was stopped and ultimately a dog sniff occurred and the court affirms that, that doesn't mean every single time that the circumstances are going to be identical. Here, we have the fact that Mr. Brown had an active Minnesota Department of Corrections warrant. So this isn't just a bench warrant. This is because in a separate incident, he was convicted of a third degree drug possession offense. He was either on supervised probation or supervised release from prison. That's not made part of the record, and he was failing to maintain contact. We have the fact that he has a cut straw on his person, in his pocket. He is asked about that by Officer Feeblecorn while he's being asked about his drug use and about his drug possession and about his prior offenses. And it is referenced specifically in Officer Feeblecorn's report because it is common knowledge that cut straws can be methamphetamine paraphernalia and are commonly used to ingest methamphetamine. We also have the fact that he was dishonest with his answers about his controlled substance use, about whether or not he had any warrants on him, about whether or not he had recently used any controlled substances or possessed controlled substances. We have the fact that multiple times he has asked frequently and interrupted Officer Feeblecorn to ask if someone could retrieve that vehicle in which he was the sole driver and the sole occupant, and he alone had keys to that vehicle. We have the major...
Ms. Johnson, can I inquire... a bit, perhaps follow up to Judge Johnson's question. It seems as from the facts, the officer himself did not think there was a basis, certainly not initial basis, to search the car. And I understand at that point, the officer knew the warrant status, saw the straw. I think there was an admission to some marijuana use and some other drugs when he was younger. So would it be safe to say that the item that the deputy felt was gave him the basis was the May report, and hence without the May report, there would not be enough, but with the May report, there is. Is that in a nutshell what was present here that added and gave the officer, at least in his own view, reasonable basis for the dog sniff?
Your Honor, that's a good question. I cannot read into Officer Feeblecorn's mind, but what I can say is that are we going to fault officers for waiting until they have three factors or four factors or five factors? When is it enough for a dog sniff at that point? Just because he didn't take to choose action at that exact moment doesn't mean he didn't have suspicions. It just means that he continued with a thorough investigation until he had felt he had enough reason to engage in an intrusion of someone's privacy rights, even a minimal intrusion, which is a dog sniff. But at this point, I don't know if that was the main factor. The fact that he took further steps to investigate and to make sure he had thorough information, thorough factors that pointed him in the right direction to justify an intrusion is an appropriate action by any officer that we would want them to do. If he had perhaps acted with just one factor, that potentially wouldn't have been reasonable suspicion. But the state's opinion is that we don't fault officers for doing a more thorough investigation than is necessary to do a bare minimum to uphold the reasonable articulable suspicion standard.
Can I ask you this question? And I just want to make sure that I understand the record with regard to what he actually knew about this prior May 9th night 2019 incident. It looks like from the incident report, and I'm looking at on page 24 of the addendum, it looks like he is saying that he reviewed that report and had understood that he was charged as a result of that incident. Is there anything in the record that indicated that he had any knowledge that the incident had been, I don't know if it was dismissed or at the time of this arrest, did he know anything more than that he had been picked up and charged according to the other incident report of that May incident? Did he know anything more than that at the time?
There is nothing in the record that supports that Officer Feeblecorn had any other information other than that there was a May 2019 report and that Mr. Brown had been charged for drug possession. There is evidence in the record for the district court's record that those charges were ultimately dismissed because the suspected narcotics were lost in the mail while being sent to the BCA. But there is nothing in the record that supports that Officer Feeblecorn was aware that those charges had been dismissed. And I'm off the top of my head, without looking at the email exchange, I'm not sure when those charges were dismissed. So I don't know if they even had been at that point. But again, there is nothing in the record that supports Officer Feeblecorn knowing that charges were eventually dismissed on that.
All right. Record. And so in reviewing this, do we take that into account that all he knew is that he had been currently charged or had current charges against him as a result of that stop in May of 2019?
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Is there any evidence in the record that indicates that those charges were dismissed before the second stop? Or this arrest 4 months later?
Your Honor, there is information, if I could have just a brief moment to review, but there is.
Thank you.
And Your Honors, to answer your question, so the email correspondence, which was made part of the record at the omnibus hearing, ultimately indicates that the county received notice, or the state of Minnesota received notice of the lost evidence approximately on September 25th, 2019, which would have been later than this incident on September 3rd, 2019. So those charges would not have yet been dismissed at the time of this incident on September 3rd.
I wonder I'm wondering if it's appropriate for us to even consider and apply the staleness case law. I mean, it seems that that case law typically comes into play when there's information provided in an application for a search warrant, and there's, you know, either an assumption or a question about whether the information is still true when it's presented to the judicial officer. In this case, I mean, in May, I mean, the substance was seized. So I mean, there's no, he could not possibly still be in possession of the same substance, you know, 4 months later. It seems like the earlier report is really just being used in a sense as, you know, to suggest that he has a predisposition, or he has a habit or a tendency. He's known to have previously been using and possessing. And I guess that information, it's not being used to show that the facts then existing are still true. It's being offered, or I guess it's being used by the officer as a backdrop to his reasoning about whether there's a reasonable suspicion that he's in possession on this date. So I don't know, any comments on that, on my comment?
Yes, Your Honor. The first part of your comment with regard to the staleness matter being addressed for probable cause purposes for search warrants, I am not aware of a single Minnesota case that has applied the staleness factor to a reasonable articulable suspicion standard for a dog sniff. In doing my research, I was not able to find a single Minnesota case that did that. My argument would be that probable cause for a search warrant is a higher standard. It is a greater intrusion. And ultimately, the staleness factor, I have not seen it applied in Minnesota case law for situations such as this. I have found in numerous cases that have been cited to in my brief, specifically state the Lugo, L-U-G-O, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court decision. The court in that case found it appropriate to consider the fact that the appellants had been arrested 2 years prior, and they considered that to be a factor. And they specifically did not raise any issues about staleness in that matter, despite the fact that that arrest was 2 years prior. They did note in that opinion that arrests not resulting in convictions may be considered when the arrest was for an offense of the same general nature. And even further in that case, the Supreme Court factored in that the appellant had lied about who owned the vehicle he was driving, as he was not the owner. And they determined and noted that the owner of the vehicle 2 years prior had been arrested on a drug offense. So they took it even a step further to look at the arrest records of the owner of a vehicle that wasn't even present. So again, no reference to staleness at all in that case. I also cited to state the Hunter, which in a reasonable articulable suspicion standard, not for a dog sniff, but for a no-knock provision on a warrant, the court found it appropriate to look at convictions that were 10 years or more older. And again, in this case, we're looking at an incident that occurred 4 months prior. And again, there was no reference to staleness. So I have not seen staleness being applied on a reasonable articulable suspicion standard in the state of Minnesota. I'm not aware if counsel has cited to anything different, but I was not able to find anything applying that standard for reasonable articulable suspicion, if that answers your question.
It is helpful. I mean, and my point was not so much about the distinction between probable cause and reasonable suspicion, but rather whether the information is being used or purported to be used to say the facts then existing are still existing, rather than just to say that the fact that this happened once in the past might lead to a reasonable suspicion that the same thing has occurring again on a new occasion.
Understood.
And I think you've addressed that by telling me about case law concerning prior arrests, for example. So thank you.
Thank you. And I would further note on that matter that, again, we're not just taking this one report, this one incident. If, again, there's case law in my brief indicating that a prior incident, if that's the only thing that an officer has, that is not reasonable articulable suspicion. And so in this case, there are numerous other factors besides this report. So there wouldn't be a situation where we're saying because it happened before, it's happening right now. There are numerous other factors to support reasonable articulable suspicion. So in conclusion, if the bench doesn't have any additional questions for me, the state of Minnesota will be asking that this court determine that there was reasonable articulable suspicion for the dog stop or the dog sniff, and that this court affirm the district court's determination. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. It appears there are no further questions for you. Mr. Umstead, as we said earlier, you have an opportunity for rebuttal in the amount of 5 minutes.
Sure. So I want to just start by answering Your Honor's question about staleness as applied in the reasonable suspicion context. I had a chance to pull up my brief, and I do cite the State versus Hunter case that opposing counsel mentioned. To be sure, that's in the context of a no-knock warrant. So it's a reasonable suspicion that has perhaps gone through the judicial process, but they do apply the staleness inquiry in that case. And then the only other case that I cited is a Montana case that suppressed a canine sniff on staleness grounds. And while we're on the topic of the Hunter case that opposing counsel relied on, I do want to emphasize when we're talking about staleness in these old criminal convictions that the several cases, State versus Hunter, State versus Lugo, and State versus Charlson, raised in the opposing counsel's response brief. In each of those cases, the old conviction records were paired with present day information that wasn't quote unquote innocent on its face. That is to say, when looking at the totality of the circumstances in those cases, there were present day information that was incriminating on its face. And that's in the State versus Hunter case. There was information establishing the defendant's continued drug activity, not did he have a bag in his car, not did he have a straw in his pocket. It was, I want to say it was an informant, although I'm just looking at my brief now, so I can't remember specifically the facts of that case, but there was an informant that told officers that this individual is still consuming drugs or dealing drugs. So that brought the prior criminal activity into the present with something a lot more concrete than a bag in the back of his car and so on. And the same goes with Lugo, where the defendant was followed from leaving a known drug house and told officers to just take him to jail. And then in Charlson, which I actually like to focus on a little bit here, because I think that Charlson is illustrative of some of the flaws in the state's case here. In that case, there was 9 week old information about a suspect's drug use. And then when the officers pulled this woman over for a traffic violation, they saw that she had track marks in her arms, her eyes were dilated, and she was acting, I guess, in a manic manner. So the officer had old information about drug use and then objective information from his own eyes that from his training says she's on drugs right now, and then called a canine to sniff the car that she was driving with dilated eyes, with track marks, with manic behavior. And the court in that case, where we've got 9 week old information and then present day information, just almost flat out demonstrating her use of drugs in that moment, the Minnesota Court of Appeals said that it was a close call, that the old information and the present day information was reasonable articulable suspicion. And so when we compare that Charleston case to the case here, in Charleston, it was the same car that she was driving, this car, while under the influence of drugs, and the canine searched that same car. It wasn't some different car. It wasn't the suspect's girlfriend's car. And then that 9-week information was rescued by present day information saying she was under the influence of drugs 9 weeks ago. She's under the influence of drugs today. And so it created that case. And on both counts, the crime place nexus and ongoing criminal activity that's incriminating on its face, both of those links from Charleston, where that was a close case, are missing in this particular case. The only present day information didn't suggest that Mr. Brown, when pulled over by Officer Feeblecorn, was engaged in any kind of drug activity, drug use, drug transport, or anything. There was just a bag in his car, the straw, and so on.
Mr. Homestead, I was just going to ask you that. Would not the straw, and I realize he had a later explanation, but the straw combined with the warrant for controlled substance offense, those two analogize this to those cases you're referring to and bring a prior controlled substance related incident to the present and provide the basis.
I'm glad to talk about the straw a little bit more, because I do think that it would require judicial notice that straws are used for criminal or for drug related activity. Because if we're just talking, straws are almost definitionally innocent on their face. They're attached to, you can go to McDonald's and get a straw, for instance. And so when Officer Feeblecorn, sure, he remarked the straw and he seized it, but he didn't dispute or didn't question or didn't ask follow-up questions about Mr. Brown's explanation. And I will point out, I think there's something in his facial deformity is maybe obliquely referenced, but there's some reference to scarring and him missing an eye in the addendum in the record. And so I only say that to say that it's not some wild, zany, off the wall explanation that he gave. And then the lack of residue, the lack of Officer Feeblecorn saying that in my training or in my experience, these are the kind of facts that are in the State versus Torres case cited by opposing counsel in her response brief and that are absent in this case. And so I think it would require judicial notice to find the straw incriminating in a vacuum. And I've gone on too long. I'm happy to clear up anything else.
Judge Slater's question also referred to the existence of the warrant in combination with other things. And
so perhaps you could
speak to that as well, please.
Yeah, well, and the warrant relates to the probation violation. And as we discussed in my opening argument, I don't think there's anything in the record, and I'm not sure there's anything even to draw an inference of drug-related activity for when Officer Feeblecorn was operating from the understanding, I think the record only supports that the violation related to not checking with the probation officer. And so I understand that it was a drug arrest or drug conviction. And I pegged that to a 2013 drug conviction. And I understand that there's this May 2019 incident that Officer Feeblecorn was operating under the understanding was a new drug charge. But I don't know that there's anything in the information to kind of provide the essential inference, the essential tie between not checking with your probation your probation officer and the drug activity being the sort of locus of that failure and that probation violation. So, you know, I'll grant you there's six items that the district court looked on. And I guess if I can just urge the court to do one thing as it considers the case, is just to imagine what those pieces of information would look like if you took the May 2019 incident out of the picture, and then to imagine the slippery slope consequences for Mr. Brown and other folks with prior criminal conduct and what that may have as a result.
Okay, it appears that there are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Umstead. Thank you, Ms. Johnson. The case was well argued and the case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.